Hey, listeners, on behalf of Vox Vignette here in Austin, thank you for downloading the podcast and being a part of our community, whether it be literally or indirectly. We also want to provide you with the opportunity to join in our mission. We are passionate about the work God has called us to, and the reality is there's a financial cost to that mission. In our first 4 years, we've been active, leading a church, starting and running Space 12, and managing two homes for intentional community. We are excited for what God has called us to, and want to invite you to partner with us. If you're interested and want more information, please go to voxaustin.com, where you'll find more about what's going on and how to get involved. If you'd like to partner with us financially, click on the giving link on the right side of the front page. Again, thanks for being a part of our extended community. We hope that the podcast has been a blessing, or at least a suitable sedative to you and your ears.
Well, this morning, we're going to continue in the lectionary, and we have a very, very unbelievably special treat. We have our good friend John Bagwell, who's going to come up and teach. John, I've known amazingly for 6 years now, and he was a part of our core when we first planted. And back when we planted, there wasn't too much diversity, and he was tall and bald and shining and a mascot of diversity in his beard and bald head. And so he's on our leadership team. He has been planted with us. I first met John through a good friend of ours. We had a mutual friend, Kyle Lake. And I was a friend of his just through pastor circles. And he was John's college pastor. And so when John was a part of the ministry through college, Kyle and his ministry had kind of deconstructed bags. And then bag, that sounds like a movie. Deconstructing bags, yeah. And then he graduated, trying to figure out what faith looks like and what it looks like to follow Jesus and to, you know, participate in what God's doing. And so he shot Kyle a note, and Kyle said, "Hey, my good buddies in Austin, Gideon." And I remember the first Sunday, Bags walked in. We were in a little tiny church in Hyde Park, and we met. And lo and behold, it's been 6 years. And so it took me 6 years to convince him to get up here, and we finally did it. So let's give Bags a warm welcome.
Yeah, yeah. Let me adjust this to the non-3-foot height. Good to see everybody today. That wasn't a knock on Gid. Come on, there was nothing. Gid doesn't need a script. I need a script. So this morning, anyway, just to kind of recap what we've been talking about here, where we've been going in our conversations. Last week, Wei was up here and he talked about repentance. You know what that looks like, and he mentioned how a lot of times, you know, we think of repentance as something that maybe we feel bad about. But he also, you know, noted that it's not just something we feel bad about, but it's something maybe we feel bad about, but realize there's a change that needs to be made there. Not only knowing there's a change that needs to be made, but being willing to make that change ourselves. So this morning, we're going to continue talking about change. And to get us started this morning, I wanted to talk a little bit about something that's, you know, one of my favorite things, one of my favorite times of the year, which just kicked off this past Thursday. Some of you guys may have an idea of what I'm talking about. I see some faces, but what's called March Madness, which is the college basketball tournament, it kicked off this past Thursday. And not just March Madness, but the first couple of days of March Madness are especially good for guys like me. You get these 12-hour blocks where you've got nothing but pure basketball, sometimes 3 and 4 games at a time. It's almost sensory overload, but there's always something good taking place. And it's just interesting to see the games, the upsets, everything that's going on. And I can remember, you know, as a 10-year-old kid sitting around the house, I'd wake up early on this Thursday morning, and there you see kind of what that looks like. I'd have those goggles on, I'd be on my couch, and I would have my bracket filled out next to me. And the purpose for the goggles, if you guys weren't here when Gid highlighted those a few weeks ago, sadly, I guess you get to hear it again. Basically, the whole story behind the goggles was, you know, I would wear these all around because I didn't know when a game might break out. You never knew. So I had these things on. And when it cut to halftime, I was running straight for the driveway. I was going to try to emulate some of these moves that I'd seen in these games and run out there and shoot hoops and then come back in and catch the second half. And so, you know, what's great about March Madness, though, is the accessibility. It seems like everybody, you know, it's filling out a bracket. We see this taking place with office brackets. And this was highlighted just the other day when Elaine actually sent me a tweet saying that she was upset Louisville had gotten knocked out in the first round to Morehead State, of all people. Who even knew that was a college? Not me. But anyway, she had them picked in her bracket pool, and so she was a little bit upset about that. And that's also what's great about March Madness is, you know, you have somebody like me that's been filling out brackets since the days of the goggles. And then you've got somebody like Elaine who maybe doesn't follow as closely. Maybe she does. But there's so much unpredictability. There's so many upsets that when it's all said and done, there's a pretty good chance that her bracket will actually destroy my bracket. And so I've always enjoyed March Madness. I've always enjoyed college basketball, watching the tournament, filling out brackets. It's always been good, but it became exceptionally good in the early 90s, in the year 1992, when something called the Fab Five arrived on the scene. And for those of you who don't know, the Fab Five was a group of five highly touted high school players. They were recruited to the University of Michigan. And at that point, when they arrived at the University of Michigan, freshman players never got many, you know, many minutes. They barely ever got on the court. Basically, the only time they were getting on the court is if it was a blowout. And so outside of that, it was unheard of for freshmen to actually start a game. And lo and behold, here about 2 months into the season, they were starting all five freshmen. First time this has ever happened in college basketball history, to the best of my knowledge. But it wasn't just their play, you know, that changed the game. It was also their style. You know, at that point in time, bald heads weren't that common, so I guess I can be happy about that. Black socks. You never saw black socks. No one was playing basketball in black socks back then. And in fact, as this documentary said, the only time you would see black socks exposed would be if you went down to Southern Florida and checked out a shuffleboard game with a bunch of retirees. And the shorts they wore at this point in time, you know, this is 1992. Doesn't seem like it was that long ago. Maybe for you guys that are younger than me, you're coming out of college, you're like, come on, I wasn't even born then. I'm trying to do the math. Is that pie? That's probably possible. But anyway, the shorts left little to be imagined. And we've actually got a clip here we'll show to illustrate that.
Anybody were to look back and look at the shorts that anybody wore in 1988 or 89, they'd be viewed as obscene now.
We had those hip huggers from the old days that looked like Speedos now.
For me personally, shorts was always an issue. The first day we got uniforms, I did exactly what I tried to do in high school, is to get the biggest pair of shorts. I picked out a nice big pair. But the problem was they were for Chip Armor. They had number 43 in it. So when Chip showed up that day, I asked him. And God bless him, he was cool with it.
Jalen initiated the baggy shorts. We were tired of the little shorts. So we went to coach one day after practice, and we said, Fish, look, we need to be comfortable.
We can't have those shorts you see in Utah with John Stockton, Karl Malone. You know, we don't want to look like that. You know, we like the shorts like how Michael Jordan wear with the Bulls, but longer.
Bottom line, it came down to coach. He said, if y'all decide to go with these baggy shorts and y'all promise y'all will win me games, then I'll do it.
So there you have it. And just like the Fab Five, you know, transformed the game of basketball, this morning we're going to take a look at the text where we see Jesus literally transforming the text we'll be looking at today. And we'll try to ask ourselves, you know, what that might look like in our own lives. And so maybe we're here this morning and we're hearing these words like transform, and we think, you know, why do we need to transform, or what does that even mean? And maybe for some of us, we're here and we're dealing with some things in our lives, you know, that we know need to be changed. We've got some bad habits. We're interested in what that might look like. And maybe for others of us, you know, maybe we've been following Christ for a few years, but we feel like it's just kind of the same old thing and nothing ever changes. And so we're interested in what that change might look like for us as well. So before we jump in, grab a couple people around you and read through Matthew chapter 17, verses 1 through 9. We're going to have it up here on the screen behind me. And I'll give you guys a couple minutes to read that to each other. And so we pick it up in verse 1, where it says, after 6 days, Jesus took with him Peter, James, and John, the brother of James, and led them up a high mountain by themselves. And we see back then, you know, Jesus goes to retreat, but he's not by himself. You know, back then, community was the norm. That was just how things were done in groups. And so we see Jesus retreat by himself, with the disciples, not by himself. And, you know, it's actually hard to find times when Jesus is by himself. I actually tried to find a few of these instances, and a few that came to mind. One of the times was after feeding 5,000 people. There was a group of people that actually wanted to make him king by force. And this was almost like they saw something, you know, this was so great, this feat that he'd accomplished. It was like, hey, you have no choice. You're becoming our king now. Well, Jesus knew the timing wasn't right, so he withdrew to be by himself. Another time we're probably familiar with was when he was led by the Spirit into the desert to be tempted by the devil. And then we also read about other times when he withdrew by himself to pray. But in all these instances, isolation, you know, withdrawing to be by yourself, this was not the norm. You know, the norm was community, and that's just how life was done back then. But for us today, the norm is not community. You know, the norm is this hyper-individualism that we see today. And it's hard when we think of transformation to think of it in anything outside of an individual standpoint. Matter of fact, when I first brought up transformation, that word this morning, we probably all thought of things like P90X and, you know, what I can do myself and individual pursuits. You know, and today, we think about, again, this individualism. What does this look like today? You know, we have personal computers. We have personal trainers. We listen to our music on iPods. And we wonder, you know, what if community was the norm again? What if we had shared computers? And what if we had communal trainers? And what if maybe instead of listening to music on iPods, we listened to our music together on something called WePods? And so this may seem pretty far removed, but maybe it's not about us changing on our own, and maybe it's about us changing together, you know, with the community. And so an example of this is actually the building that we're sitting in today here, Space 12. Some of you guys may be familiar with the history of this building, but before we moved in here, it was actually a nightclub called Chester's that had all kinds of problems. And I remember when Chester's was shut down, I was talking with Gid, and he said, so we're thinking about moving into Chester's. And my reaction was, what? Does this mean it's the end of male stripper night? Which they actually used to have up here. That gives you kind of a feel for the place that we were talking about. But we all dived into this together. This was something that we took on as a community. And we knew God was calling us to do something special with this place, although we didn't really know what that looked like at the time. You know, we had a vague feel for it initially. But as we got into it, you know, we had these long nights up here where we were ripping sheetrock out of the ceilings and guys were pulling nails out of their shoes. And we had to be thinking, you know, what have we gotten ourselves into? What are we really, you know, doing here? But now we see the space is transformed. There's all kind of opportunities that we couldn't have envisioned that have come to fruition. You know, there's a partnership we have here with Inside Books, which provides books to prison inmates. This is a place where neighborhood associations come to meet. You know, a place where we can screen films like Race to Nowhere about educational problems, and a place for nonprofits to hold fundraisers, like the art show that we had here a little while back to raise support for Evans Ministry in Afghanistan. And so our hope then is that maybe this building can become a metaphor for us as a community. And just like we've seen this change here in this building, that as a community, you know, maybe we can grow together and maybe we can change too. And maybe we can look at it like something, you know, that we can walk together through, just like the disciples walked together in the text we're looking at today. And some of you guys may be aware, maybe some of you aren't, we talked about Slashies. The one that was not mentioned was the book club. We actually have a book club at Vox, and sometimes we actually read books. Sometimes we finish them. Right now, we're kind of stuck in the middle of one. But I can remember here about a year ago, we read a book called The Omnivore's Dilemma. And I can remember sitting here in this space, actually, right around here. I think there was, like, Michael Hsu, and I think Elaine was here. Jenny Brown and Nick Deere may have been here as well. And we were talking, you know, about all this talk. What does all this organic mean? And what is free-range chicken, and what is natural, and is it really important for us to pay more for these kind of things? And we started to dive into that and to talk about that together, you know, as a group. And I remember coming fresh off this conversation one day, Margarita and I were driving around. We were out running errands one Saturday, and we were looking for something to eat. She said, oh, let's just pull into Chick-fil-A. We'll grab some chicken because I think their chicken there is all natural. And I said, you know, actually, I don't think it is. And then she's like, oh, forget it. I don't want to go to Chick-fil-A anymore. So all of a sudden, there's this change that's taken place because of these conversations that we had. And you know, these conversations changed the way that I looked at food and where it comes from. And maybe in the same way, you know, we look back in the text and we see that this kind of change would occur with the disciples as they're up on the mountain with Jesus. And so we look at this and wonder, you know, what does this mean for us as a community? What does this mean? What do we take away from this? Maybe it looks like meeting up in some of our neighborhood groups, which is our small groups that meet throughout the week. And, you know, maybe we can talk about some of our struggles and realize that we actually share some of the same struggles and can work through some of those together. And maybe it looks like from a bigger picture, you know, hearing something like we did here a little while back, that AISD was going to be closing a number of exemplary schools throughout the area. And a number of people in our community were able to brainstorm, you know, what do we do with this? How do we fight this? And able to form, you know, a coalition of different voices from different schools that could be heard, that could maybe be more powerful than a bunch of separate groups just speaking out on their own. And so, again, we have Jesus, and he's with Peter, James, and John up on the mountain. And we pick it up in verse 2 where it says, "There he was transfigured before them. His face shone like the sun, and his clothes became as white as the light. And just then there appeared before them Moses and Elijah talking with Jesus." And this all happens so quickly. You know, we hear they're on a mountain, and then all of a sudden we look up and it says, oh yeah, and pow, Jesus is transfigured. And we think, what does that even mean? It happens so quickly. And so we look at a definition, and the word literally means transfiguration, to change into another form, to transfigure. And we also see it used two other notable times in Scripture. There's the case in Romans 12:2. Where it says, "Do not conform any longer to the pattern of this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind." We also see it in 2 Corinthians 2:18, where it says, "And we, who with unveiled faces all reflect the Lord's glory, are being transformed into his likeness." And so we've got Jesus, Peter, James, and John. They're up on this mountain. We hear that Jesus is transfigured. We're still trying to figure out what that really looks like. And we wonder, you know, what's the context here? We hear that they're on a mountain, and we think this mountain was probably Mount Hermon, which is about 9,000 feet tall. It's located in Israel. I think we've got a picture of it, actually, modern day. So you see there, it's actually a place where people can ski today. So maybe it's interesting to think that, you know, right through where the Bunny Hill runs, Jesus Christ was being transfigured. But hopefully, maybe that can provide a little bit of context into this, you know, real life. This wasn't just a fairy tale, but this was something that really happened. And so, you know, we see the snow and we hear that that Jesus was transfigured and there was this radiant, bright light. And we think, well, there's snow and there's this white light. Maybe it would just blend in. But commentaries actually tell us that it would have been like staring into the sun, and obviously would have been a big difference from just looking and blending into the snow. And so we also see what happens to Jesus up on the mountain. A similar thing occurs to Moses when he goes up on a mountain to meet face to face with God. You know, the story of Moses receiving the Ten Commandments. And so we see Moses, he goes up and he has this interaction with God. He has the Ten Commandments. He's coming down the mountain. He thinks life is great. He gets down to the bottom, and then all of a sudden he realizes nobody in this community wants to be around him. They're acting like they're kind of afraid. And he's thinking, you know, what is going on? You know, everything was great when I left. I came down. You guys aren't even worshiping a calf this time. Did you hide the calf? What's going on? This is something that happened before. And he realizes they're actually afraid to come near him because it looks like his face is literally on fire. And I had kind of a similar experience. See, we have a gas grill at our house, and it's on our back deck. And this was probably about a few months ago. We were talking, you know, what are we going to eat tonight? And, you know, Margarita says, well, you know, why don't we grill out on the, you know, grill out on the deck? I said, okay, that'll work. Let's do it. Well, so I go out there. I try to light it up. This is one of those gas grills, and it's, you know, it's got one of those fancy automatic ignition buttons, which would come highly recommended, except for it didn't work, and it still doesn't work. And so I think, okay, no big deal. I've got a grill lighter. I can do this the manual way. So I crank up the gas just about as high as it'll go. I've got all four burners on. And it's just kind of, you know, that hiss that you hear. It's kind of humming. And for some reason, it doesn't occur to me to stick the grill lighter in the side. And I just open up the top, reach my hand out, and I pull the trigger. And as you can imagine, this kind of minor explosion takes place right in front of my face. And luckily, my face wasn't at the same place where my hand was, because I think it successfully singed about all these hairs off. Now they've grown back. So I could have made that excuse, you know, if my head was there. But yeah, anyway. So I come inside the house, and I realize, kind of like Moses, you know, my wife didn't really want to be around me either. As soon as I walked in, she's like, is something burning? And before I could say anything, she walks a little bit closer to me, and she goes, oh, it's you. Gross. And so just like, and I'm sorry, so while my face may have literally almost been lit on fire because of my stupidity, we see Moses' face was actually radiant because he had been speaking face to face with God. And so just like Moses' face was radiant in light, the transfiguration, if we go back to the text, go back to the mountain, we see Jesus appeared in a similar way. And at this point, you're probably wondering, what's the point of all this light? We've got Jesus radiating, we got Moses radiating, we got people glowing. And I think we look back to when Jesus says, I am the light. And we ask ourselves, you know, what would that look like if that light came into our lives? What if that light came in and shined on every part of who we are? You know, what would that actually reveal? And so as we're thinking about the transfiguration and we look at light, you know, we think about it as something that's revealing. And I don't know if you guys have ever been in a blackout before, but if you have, you know how important that flashlight is in those moments. I know because I've been told before. You know, see, I have this, if some of you know me, probably horrible organization about me. Just not very organized. And so we've had a situation where the lights go out and I'm looking around for the flashlight and there's no way I'm going to find it because it's buried beneath a pile of junk that I'd even have trouble finding if the lights were on. But if I can miraculously somehow put my hands on this thing, I guarantee you it's not going to have batteries. So for those of you that are not married, if you want to take some mental notes this morning, if you want to find a way to make sure your wife is not happy, just wait till there's a blackout and all she wants is a flashlight and you can't produce that. But we think, you know, what if you're in a blackout and you can find a flashlight? You know, what would that look like? How much would that actually reveal? You know, all these things you couldn't see before, you're kind of staring into blackness and all of a sudden, you know, those things are revealed. So we look back at this glowing light from Jesus' transfiguration and imagine what that would look like and what that would reveal, you know, in our own lives. And so you guys probably all know me from Austin. I'm originally from Dallas and I moved down here in about 2003. And at the time I was living, kind of got suckered into this actually. Didn't know anything about Austin, and me and another buddy were moving down here, and one of our friends was from Lake Travis, and he told us that's where all the action was. That's where we needed to be, was out of the lake. So we moved in and quickly realized we were about 30 minutes from where all the action was. And so for some reason, not the guy that was from Lake Travis, but another roommate, he thought for some reason I was actually funny, and he was just obsessed with this idea. It would be the greatest thing ever if we could get you up on stage at Esther's Follies, which is a comedy club, if you guys don't know, on 6th Street. And so he kept trying to talk to me. He said, listen, they've got open mic night. This is great. You know, you should come out there. And I'm saying, no. This is not going to happen. This is a horrible idea. And I kept saying no, and he kept saying yes. And then one day he calls me up at work. And I was actually, you know, this is tell you about the time frame. Maybe I was actually pretty busy at the time. And he kept asking me, he kept telling me about all these opportunities for me to do stand-up. And I kept saying, listen, I'm not doing stand-up. I'm not going up there. This is not going to happen. And, of course, he doesn't listen. He doesn't hear it. He just keeps pitching, and he keeps pitching. And I keep saying, I got to go. I got to do stuff. And he keeps on going on. And so finally, in this, like, Jacob Esau moment, he says, you know, what if I just signed you up? Would you do it? And in order to get off the phone with him, I said, sure, you sign me up, I'll do it. Goodbye. Hang up the phone. Well, I get home that night, and he's grinning from ear to ear. And he's like, guess what? You're going on next week. Esther's Follies, open mic night. And so I'm like, you've got to be kidding me. You know, the gravity of the situation starts to hit me. I realize I'm going to be up at a comedy club doing what? I don't have any material. He's like, yeah, you've got plenty of material. I don't know any of this. So I sit down. I start to prepare. I work up a little routine. And I actually kind of talk myself into thinking this was like halfway decent. I'm like, yeah, I'm going to get some laughs. This will be all right. And I'm like, but here's the deal. You can't tell anyone. And he's like, yeah, no problem, no problem. So we show up at Esther's Follies, and I realize he's told everybody he knew. And at the time, we just moved down to Austin, so that means we probably had like 15, 20 people that drove down from Dallas. And so now I'm thinking, not only am I doing this, you know, I thought I was just going to have a bet with a bunch of strangers and my roommate, but now there's all these people I know that are here to take in the show. Great. And so we show up, and I guess we got there a little bit late, or maybe we just didn't realize that there's so many people that actually have an interest in open mic comedy night. But we show up, and I get put at the end of the list, and we've got to sit through 2, maybe 3 hours of the most grueling, most excruciating stand-up comedy you can imagine. But then finally, it's time for my moment to shine. It's time for me to get up there and go through my routine. So I'm confident. I get up there, and the bright lights hit me, and all I can see is this light, and it's beating down on me. And that light revealed that my comedy routine really wasn't that funny, that my material really wasn't that good. You know, I'd say something, I'd pause for emphasis, and I'd kind of look out through the light, and then I'd see nothing but blank faces staring back at me. And then I'd hear a couple laughs, I'd get all excited, and I'd look over, and I'd see, oh, that's just a couple guys I know that are laughing at me, not with me, because it's so horrible. And, you know, Kyle Lake, who Ged mentioned earlier, he actually saw footage of this. You know, there was, at a time, there was a DVD of this, which I hope is in a million pieces at the bottom of the ocean somewhere. But Kyle saw this DVD, and this was his assessment. Bags is funny. This isn't funny. And so we think about this spotlight and this light that revealed how horrible I was at stand-up. And maybe we think about this light that was coming from Jesus at the Transfiguration. And if that light were to shine on us, you know, what would it reveal? And what does this look like for us? Maybe it looks like, again, getting together in some of our small groups this past week. We were hanging out and we were talking about committing to things and commitments. And I talked about how I'm horrible with actually committing to things, that I don't want to commit. I always want to keep the options open. And so instead of just saying yes, many times I'll say, we'll see, which is funny because that's the same thing my parents told me when they wanted to politely tell me no as a kid. And maybe that's why community is so difficult, you know, because it reveals how broken we are, you know, and the faults that we have. But maybe there's also a healthy nature to that, that in being vulnerable and being exposed and being honest with each other, there's some growth that can come out of that and growth that can happen, you know, as a community. So we go back to the text, you know, we pick it up here in verse 4, and it says, Peter said to Jesus, Lord, it is good for us to be here. If you wish, I'll put up 3 shelters, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah. And so then we see this cloud that covers them, comes out of nowhere. The voice of God comes and says, listen to my son. The disciples are terrified. They fall down on the ground. Next thing we see, Jesus is tapping them on the back, telling them not to be afraid and to get up. And so finally we pick it up in verse 9 that tells us, as they were coming down the mountain, Jesus instructed them, don't tell anyone what you've seen until the Son of Man has been raised from the dead. And so we've got Peter here, and he's fixated on this dramatic event. You know, he thinks they should stay there indefinitely. He's talking about building shelters. And then we see Jesus, and he's saying, all right, get up, let's go. So we wonder, you know, what's going on? We've got these two varying takes on this this event, this situation. And I kind of picture Peter as this good-natured guy, you know, this good-natured guy that's always talking, always running his mouth, but, you know, in a pretty good way. And I almost imagine him kind of like Oprah when she handed out the cars. I imagine Peter getting all excited and saying, guys, it's good for us to be here. Jesus, you get a shelter. Moses, you get a shelter. Elijah, you get a shelter. And then he just keeps on going, and he keeps on going. He says, this is great, Jesus. Maybe you can do that light-up thing again. Maybe you can do some cool things we've never seen before. We could stay up here forever. We can roast marshmallows. And then right then, something just comes bellowing out of a cloud. That sounds probably the only thing we could equate it to would be the voice of James Earl Jones. I know that doesn't do it justice. But it's the voice of God, and these disciples, they just fall to the ground, and they're terrified. And then we see Jesus come over, and he tells them to get up and to walk down the mountain with him. And then he says, oh, yeah, and by the way, don't tell anybody what you've seen. And so we start to think, wait a minute, don't tell anybody what you've seen. You just saw Jesus Christ transfigured on a mountain, and you're supposed to hold that in? And we think, what would that look like today? I think Peter would respond and say, sorry, Jesus, I already fired off 5 tweets, and most of those had twit pics. And I think James would have said, Jesus, I already posted an album to Facebook. It's called Mount Hermon with JC. Do you want me to delete that? And then maybe John would have been texting back and forth with his parents saying, who's this guy my brother's been hanging out with? Let me tell you what he did up on top of this mountain. OMG. And by the way, OMG would have never been used as correctly as it would have been in this instance. And so maybe, and so we've got Peter, and he's trying to focus on this event. You know, he's fixated on it. He can't get around it. He can't see the bigger picture. But Jesus is trying to show them, you know, this is part of a larger process. And so, you know, maybe we experience kind of the same thing in our lives. We've experienced something, some event, or something that's just been so good that we spend the rest of our lives trying to go back to that or trying to recreate that experience. You know, maybe for us, you know, some of us maybe had a great high school. We have all these memories that we keep clinging to, and we're trying to recreate that experience, and it's hard for us to move on. You know, maybe we spend time on Facebook trying to recreate that, or maybe there's ways that, you know, we can't move on and build new relationships. We just keep clinging to those of the past. And maybe it looks something like this. I think we've got a clip here.
Back in 82, I used to be able to throw a pigskin a quarter mile.
Are you serious?
I'm dead serious. Watch this.
What the heck are you doing?
That's what I'm talking about.
I better go.
How much you want to make a bet I can throw a football over them mountains? Yeah, if a coach would have put me in fourth quarter, we'd have been state champions, no doubt. No doubt in my mind. You better believe things would have been different. I'd have gone pro. In a heartbeat. I'd be making millions of dollars and living in a big old mansion somewhere. You know, soaking it up in a hot tub with my soulmate. Kip, I reckon you know a lot about cyberspace. You ever come across anything like time travel?
Easy. I've already looked into it for myself.
Right on. Right on.
And so it's easy for us, you know, to sit back and laugh at Uncle Rico, the tight shirt. He's throwing stakes around. You know, what do you think I can throw the football over this mountain? You know, how can you not laugh at that? But it's kind of maybe sad when we start to think about how we're prone to some of the same things. You know, maybe not that dramatic, but, you know, we have a habit of having a great experience and then instead of trying to go on with the process of life, trying to go back and recreate that experience. You know, we have an easy time consuming, but sometimes a difficult time actually doing. And, you know, maybe for some of us, maybe we have had an experience like that on a Sunday morning at Vox. And instead of going on, you know, with our lives and with the process of life, maybe we try to recreate that by coming back on a Sunday and hoping that reoccurs to us in the same way. Yeah, but we have to think at the end of our services, if you've been here before and you'll see it today, there's a reason for the benediction we have. And if we take those words where we say, go and live the church, and we come back the next Sunday unchanged, you know, maybe we're too focused on an event and not focused enough on the process of life, kind of like Peter in the text. And so we see Peter, again, he's fixated on this moment. He can't get his head around it, and he's sometimes struggles to see the big picture. But it's funny because in Peter's life, we would also see him go on to undergo a tremendous transformation himself. You know, before the transfiguration, Peter's just come to the realization that Jesus is the Son of God. But Peter also has his own struggles. You know, he struggles again to see the big picture. One time, Jesus actually has to tell him, "Get behind me," and refers to him as Satan. You know, another time, Jesus is taken away to be crucified, and Peter actually denies that he even knows Jesus three separate times. These are just kind of, you know, bumps in the road, and they're not things that that Peter would want to live through. But it's part of this transformation process, and we see Peter go on to become a key leader in the church. You know, it's Peter that stands up at Pentecost, delivers this speech that immediately leads to the conversion of 3,000 people. You know, it's Peter that brings the story of Christ to outsiders who were previously disregarded. And it's Peter who goes on to do great things for the early church. And maybe this provides us as some kind, you know, with some kind of an image of what can happen with our own lives. You know, maybe we're not happy with where we are right now, but maybe there's room for growth and we can transform and we can move forward as well. And, you know, maybe it's not a one-time occurrence or a one-time event, you know, that we should be contemplating or trying to wrap our minds around or trying to recreate. But instead, maybe it's a process or a season. So this morning, you know, we'll have an opportunity to take part in communion with Christ. And when we think about the transfiguration of Jesus up on the mountain, and we think about how our lives can be transformed because of him, Let's spend some time reflecting on that and thinking how it applies to our lives. Let me pray for us.